Now, what I'm going to try and do for my own sake and hopefully for our collective learning is to try to hear back from you on what you think you've heard said today, which you can't get this wrong, because if it's wrong, then it's my fault. So if you say something that that I didn't mean to communicate, then it will be I'll be the one that looks bad. So don't. It's not like a thing where you can get it wrong. But what just as we capture our learnings and then hit the home straight, what have you understood from? What are some things you learnt this morning? Like I say, if you get it wrong, then that's my bad. So here we go.
There's no sort of linear decline.
Yeah, I reckon that's a big thing. It's not a linear decline. There were. It's not from point. Science to death of Christianity, it's up and down, yep, absolutely. Yes?
It's not straightforwardly our fault because it's pan-national.
Yeah, that's right, not straightforwardly our fault. Like, it's always, I think the reason not to be an unsafe church is because Jesus wouldn't want us to be that, but not because that's why people aren't coming to church. Or because we haven't got it in sufficient... Yeah, that's right. We need to think bigger about the reasons why, absolutely. Yep. Anything you think you've heard said that you wouldn't agree with, like you think it's what I'm saying, but you wouldn't want to come with me on it? They're both... Oh, yes, Elsa. Yes. Yes.
Whereas even prior to the 80s, they did, like the European countries. So it's kind of like we're also getting a lot of immigration from countries that aren't, which is influencing the statistics.
Yes. That's right. I'm an arts graduate, and so I get nervous about what happens to numbers when they go into my head. And so I had the impression that what I said was right, and I checked with a demographer who said that that's mostly what's happening, and that immigration, I think, is net neutral or something like that. Like, there's a lot of religious, as in what immigration does is not the number one cause of that decline. But now, that decline is not... now, that's not saying that in 2011 there were 900,000 people in church singing praises to Jesus, evangelising their friends, and by 2016 they thought, I'm sick of this. Almost certainly what it is people who thought, oh, I don't know, Christian, to, oh, cool, I've got permission to not be anything now. And so I think this is where, did I say this out loud or over lunch? I think this is where Tom Frame is very, he's helpful in many ways, including, he thinks that, the new atheism gave those guys permission to be nothing, but they didn't convert anyone. That people who were ostensibly nothing were given a category nothing and said, oh great, I can be a proud nothing rather than kind of a sheepish nothing. Yeah. Yeah. Cool. Thank you. That's very gratifying. I think they are the things I'd really want to understand. The complexity of what's happened, the non-linear state of it, and the way the evidence doesn't support. I think the scientific revolution is very relevant, and enlightenment and stuff like that, but it does not support an idea that people worked out that Christianity wasn't true and then eventually bailed. It's a way more complicated thing. And in some ways the other way, like as probably most people in this room realise, the nature of the scientific enterprise was so religious and specifically Christian that it's sort of ludicrous to make a one-step move. Yes. Okay, so I do also want to be heard to say that all those things are relevant, everything we've talked about, but it turns out roughly, I think that 1963, that basically kind of sex got us into this problem, and maybe sex can get us out of it, but it does seem that the trigger, whether the Kindle was kept dry by a whole lot of intellectual and other causes, it seems like the Kindle that lit the fire was the radical reorganisation of family life that came about in the 1960s, made possible by the pill and a whole lot of other things. But that change to family life seems to have been the thing that lit the fire, or that made that breaking with church life and with Christianity possible. So things like I can send these references in an email if that's helpful. But Frank and Oconee talk a lot about the welfare state and the way, not being critical of the welfare state, but that the welfare state supplies a whole lot of things that families used to supply, and that things that were once supplied by families and by churches, by religious organisations, were now supplied by the family state, by the welfare state in the post-war years, which is the other main, like the pill and the welfare state are these two kind of technologies, broadly considered, that made a restructuring of family life possible. I guess the argument is that change is causal rather than just correlative. So everyone who talks about secularisation theory, observes secularisation, notices that you have two things, a decline of family life and a decline of religious life, but increasingly the sociology and the history is moving to putting those... And then historically the causal relationship was people stop believing in God, therefore they stop worrying about what God says about how you're supposed to have families or who you're supposed to sleep with or whatever. And it seems increasingly likely that it's the other way around, that the disintegration of family life makes possible the disintegration of like church life, that those things come together in very powerful powerful ways. So the kind of evidence for this sort of thinking is that family decline does accompany religious decline, that they're correlated at first, but then they become predictive in different areas. So family and faith fall first in France. So many Fs. There's a whole lot of research done on what happens with like children born out of wedlock and so on, and how correlated that is in France, and so there are reasons to expect. And then it falls last in Ireland. In Ireland, it's kind of happening now, and as family life radically changes in Ireland, so does the people stop going to church. The Scandinavian situation, so Scandinavia is both the most, something like Sweden, is both the most secular place in the world and the most, the least kind of family-oriented, one of the least family-oriented places in the world. It explains the religious booms that often accompany baby booms, like in the 1950s, you have a baby boom and a religious boom here, and it explains a fair bit of the USA, which is its own this kind of buck the trend rich Western nation. So Richard Dawkins says the paradox has often been noted that the United States, founded in secularism, is now the most religious country in Christendom, while England, with an established church headed by a constitutional monarchy, is among the least. I'm continually asked why this is, and I do not know. And it is a great curiosity. Again, people have said it's the uniqueness of the founding model of America, that it's religious, escaping religious persecution, and it's the Constitution and so on like that. And they all no doubt have an effect. But the USA was a place with a relatively high birth rate at a time when Western Europe, and Australia and others went in for a low birth rate. It certainly doesn't explain, the forwarding of Christianity, which is so often being done by people who are not married, so it's not making a correlation to say that marriage equals anything like Christian faithfulness or whatever, and on the contrary. But it does seem to be that structure is the thing that explains, to a large extent, our moment after the 1960s. Why that is, it seems like there might be some apologetic experience within family life itself, that the whole experience of inconvenience and sacrifice and knowing God as your father and Christian brotherhood and stuff like that are all things that aren't available to a Scandinavian person in the way that they are to someone who has experienced family life in certain ways. And the kind of conservative force of children, that if you have the gap between, as you say, between your confirmation and your marriage used to be tiny in European society. So say that you were kind of confirmed in the church at 14 and you were married by 19, you know, this tiny window to kind of roam free, and then when children come, you know, everyone starts, you know, kind of wearing jumpers and voting Liberal and, or just you, the things in your life that you do want to, bring into Christian faith. So it could be that those, I think that, is the kind of, the missing link in the sharp sudden decline, is that restructuring of family life, that it feels like we, that Christians have, Christian churches have suffered from and have struggled to recover from, in the wake of the revolution. So summary, and then on to the other stuff. The prevailing atheist accounts from top down don't seem to work with the evidence. Christianity's gone up and down. The moment in the 1960s seems largely to do with the change in sex and married life. And I think the changes in the last 10 years are probably still part of the sexual revolution, which has kind of morphed and become something different. So as much as you'd like it to be about a whole lot of stuff, it feels like kind of about sex. And I kind of get frustrated in the public discourse that it's like sex, 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 sex. And then Christians are like, Jesus, and tell me about sex. And he's like, why are you talking about sex? You think, oh, you were talking about it. Like, it was the, it's the thing that we live in, and it's kind of morphed into that identity, politics and so on. And so, mentally, secularization, has made possible secularism, created the context for that exclusive humanism, that is, such a popular, way to live and move and have your being in the world. Alright. That's our moment. I want to get on to thinking about a Christian response to all this, but do you want to push back, talk back, say anything? Cool. All right, here we go. Home stretch. What do you, if you think about that, I think one of the insights of the that moment in the 60s is that almost everything since the 60s is in some way a response to that radical secularization of our culture. Or willfully ignoring the radicalization or secularization of our culture. Well, how would you, in your own kind of map of the history of our culture and our Christian witness, what do you think about that? I think about the 60s, the 70s, the 80s, the 90s. What do you see as Christians grappling with and trying to do ministry, faithful or otherwise, in the wake of that revolution? Who do you want in that story?
I don't know if I want them in the story, but I'm reflecting on that period in the 1970s when there was a wave of Christian interest in the last things.
Yes,
and
yep.
That kind of sense of almost predicting, oh golly, if we stay on this decline track, I can now see very quickly the end of all things and the horror coming and the Babylon coming from the book of Revelation. And suddenly that part of scripture came alive in the light of and operated kind of as a warning, I think, in things like Late Great Planet Earth.
Yeah.
And the kind of surprising 1970s Christian film industry.
Yes.
It was built around kind of warning the end times based on, oh my goodness, look where we're going.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, now, we're thinking sociologically this afternoon. You can ask the question biblically, is premillennialism or postmillennialism true? And that's a legitimate question, but you can also ask, under which conditions do they flourish? And postmillennialism, of course, flourished in the Victorian and Enlightenment era. All those guys, like, you know, Wilberforce and so on, because you see everything progressing, and so of course an eschatology that says Christianity is also progressing makes immediate sense to you, and you've got a very elegant and in its own way beautiful Christian theory of politics, which is to say that Jesus is in charge of everything and he'll eventually conquer the whole world, and Jesus wouldn't like slavery, therefore let's get rid of slavery. Whereas that kind of 70s kind of nervous premillennial eschatology, again, makes sense. If you feel like everything's falling apart, the whole everything that I, you know, cherished about Christian values and stuff seems to be, yeah, so great example. Yes?
If everything's falling apart at that time, do you think therefore the charismatic movement came in in a way of empowering and confidence?
Yes. So I think the charismatic movement, you'd absolutely, again, we're thinking like sociologists, so not, there's a subsequent question, is that a correct or incorrect account or a mediated account or whatever. But I think that the immediacy of charismatic experience, the way that it circumvented that 60s aversion to authority and institutional authority and so on, and had a direct encounter with God, and that if you think of that that imminent frame of exclusive humanism, it makes sense. Not that charismatic thing isn't transcendent, but that that expressive, fulfilling immediacy. Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense in that context. Yes.
Corresponding to that, you've got like the super sensitive church of Willow Creek.
Yes.
That sort of almost doesn't deny the supernatural, but it sort of just plays down and sort of makes everything very normal.
Yeah.
It's the imminent frames of where we're at, and they're kind of happening at the same time.
Yeah, that's right. So you've got that early phase Pentecostal, neo-Pentecostalism that's very anything could happen at any moment, and then the kind of seeker-sensitive stuff, which is a much more kind of let's here's us and here's the culture. Let's get the lines of communication open as easily and as open as we can, and to make this as friendly as possible. Yeah. Yeah. Yes.
I think also the religious right in America.
Yep.
Here, Graham used the religious right in power. And there's a real, plea on that and indulging politics.
Yes. Yep. So the religious right, it's almost based on a theory, which I think is like a bit of a mistaken theory that, of how cultures change, but to think, this is all changing around me. If I change who's in charge at the top, that will then flow down into everything else. And I think the rise of the religious right is definitely a response to that, whether it was like how wise the response was or how successful it was or whatever. But yes, I think that's right. Yeah.
My reflection of watching what's going on in Sydney, especially in the Anglican circles,
yeah.
Liturgy was just going, the older forms of liturgy was being dealt.
Yes.
And that was quite interesting to watch.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. And now... Now I lived in Sydney for 4 years and I did this thesis on Donald Robinson, but I feel like looking at it from the outside, wasn't there, but it's absolutely striking the way you hit the 60s and the 70s and the 80s, 90s and that, the huge battle between, intra-Anglican battle about do we maintain the forms of the prayer book and the liturgy, and it was a painful battle because it wasn't goodies and baddies. It was like people like Philip Jensen at loggerheads with people like Donald Robinson. Meanwhile, Philip is preaching Donald Robinson's biblical theology. So you know what I mean? It's not like it was a particularly painful battle because you couldn't draw the lines theologically, but there was a profound
churchmanship.
And I think missiology. How are we going to reach this group now? And this very profound sense that the way you're doing it, the Edwardian church experience, will not cut it with this generation. Again, the argument over divorce, that generation were all largely arguing for a relaxation of divorce laws, whereas the older generation, that was a huge part of that. Parish boundaries... I think you could not understand that movement apart from the moment of the post-60s secularisation. Yeah. And it's an interesting one because at one level, if you compare that with the seeker church movement, a Venn diagram would give you a fair bit of crossover because the argument for the liturgy wasn't, oh, this liturgy makes you worship Mary and it's all weird and blasphemous and we don't want it. But like, this liturgy is exactly the theology I want, but I don't want you to make my mate say it when he comes to my church. Which is exactly seeker-sensitive thinking, but seeker-sensitive movement in the United States tended to want to lower the bar across the board, whereas that movement that Owen's talking about had a simultaneous massive decrease in the difference between the weirdness of the experience of coming to church on a Sunday, but it actually amped up the theological difference. So the rhetoric between church and world were much stronger than the more Edwardian Anglicans. So do you see the irony? Like the older Anglicans had the parish church model and not a strong sense of membership, whereas that newer movement had a very strong sense of almost a kind of free church sense of how you thought about the church and the community, but a seeker sense, yeah, so, you know, complex, but kind of, you were there. I'm kind of mansplaining away stuff that, Yes?
So maybe we're acknowledging then the next phase that came after that kind of post-seeker sensitive, the kind of ancient future church, the recapturing the kind of ancient church practices to give life and meaning in death.
Yep.
To actually kind of re-engage people in something other than just a cognitive kind of manner.
Yeah.
I thought that was a very fascinating way to, especially because a lot of the argument in the literature around it was about re-engaging younger generations who apparently wanted that all along.
Yes.
If only we had stuck with campus and liturgy, we would have been fine all along.
That's right. Which is, and it's a whole huge and ironic series of arguments that you have a generation in the 80s and 90s of leadership I'm talking about who say, this thing will not survive if you insist on the old liturgy. And then you lose, you have so many battle scars out of that fight. And then you come to a generation and they're like, oh, what'd you do with all the candles? And I want my prayer book. Now, I don't think that generation wants what the last generation think they want. Because they hear it and they say, dude, I spent 30, look, there's a scar here, and this scene would have imploded if I hadn't fought like that. But that person, that millennial, is much more cafeteria in the liturgy that they want, and less inclined to submit themselves to the entire tradition in a whole thing. But it still is a bit of data. Like, I think actually it's silly in the kind of thinking that we're trying to do together. It's silly to say that's silly. Because even if you think that is the worst thing in the world, it's still, you've got to diagnose it and say, what does it mean that a bunch of people want the opposite of what we fought to get rid of in the 90s? And to make sense of, even if you think it's the wrong solution to the problem, that's a symptom of something. Yeah. Do you know what the answer is?
Do I know what the answer is?
Yeah. Okay.
Jesus.
God and the Bible.
Yes.
Okay, let me bring together a couple of things, and then we're going to open up, and then we're going to be done. So I think the thing I want to talk about here, so if you roughly think of the... One of the big takeaways, if sex and a change of the sexual ethical code and the way families are structured and stuff like that, if that is the kind of the smoking gun in the 60s, not discounting all the other stuff we talked about, if that's kind of this huge thing that explains that moment, then it probably goes without saying, but it is worth saying, in fact, no, it's absolutely worth saying, that the thing that has been historically, so say you've got no theological dog in this fight, historically the worst thing to do for your survival, the survival of your church, is to make peace with the sexual revolution. So even if you thought, I don't care, I'm pro-sexual revolution, anti-whatever, just on sheer indices of the moment the churches in the United States, the churches in Britain, in Australia, whatever, that said, we will roll over on that and lean toward you on a rigid sexual ethic, that's kind of like the number one indicator that you die. The book by Mary Ebersart, she talks about that. She has a whole chapter called Assisted Suicide. And her whole section on assisted suicide, so she's the one who's really, along with Callum Brown and others, I've seen that thing, but powerfully argued that thesis, says that given how disastrous that change of sexual code was to the churches, to encourage that sexual code is to say, could the last one please turn out the lights? Cool. Now, if you were a convinced progressive Christian or whatever, you might still say, oh, but I still think that's true. Just like I might say, even if it turns out that the number one thing that puts people off about Jesus is that Jesus is Lord, I'm not going to change that, because you know, there could be a liberal Christian that thinks, well, I don't care, I'm still not going to change that. But on a purely utilitarian ground, if you want your church to survive, that's the worst possible scenario. Just empirically, it doesn't work. So if you think about the kind of responses that we've talked about, so you have the 60s, so you have the John Robinson, J.T. Robinson, and the churches that try to make peace with the sexual revolution and reject the ethics, that's kind of turned out to be disastrous in terms of the survival of those churches. You have the Jesus people, which is an important movement, Pentecostalism and so on. Then in the 80s and 90s, the seeker-friendly movement, which again is trying to rejig that relationship. I think that's actually really important. Like, I wouldn't want to undermine that how much in the wake of that cultural revolution people did need to think, how am I signalling and how hard am I making it for people to be a part of this? That was really kind of important work that we all reaped the benefits of. Mega churches and that kind of, I guess, slightly counterintuitive rebirth of reform theology and so on. I think in our moment, when I was preparing this material, I kept thinking, oh, there'll be like, I'll discover these kind of five or six options, or at least three. You want things to be in threes, and there's X, Y, or Z, and so on. But I think my observation is once you kind of think, at an evangelical conference, we're not looking at non-evangelical options, and so amongst the kind of evangelical ether, it does seem to me that in different language and in different ways and to greater or lesser degrees, there is a near consensus or convergence, I would say, on the conviction that now is not the time to lower or lessen or sell at a bargain basement our distinctive Christian witness. That's a really long way of saying the Benedict option, but that's what I'm trying to say. So how many people have heard that phrase, the Benedict option? So let me explain this to you. So there's a American author called Rod Dura, I think that's how you pronounce it, D-R-E-H-E-R, who's an American conservative. His own story is a move from the mainline church. See you, Andrew, go well on Tuesday. It's a great initiative. He went from the mainline churches, converted to Roman Catholicism, and he's a journalist and did a whole lot of work during the kind of the scandals. And anyway, and he's ended up becoming an Orthodox believer. So he says in an interview with Al Mohler, the only thing he hasn't tried is evangelicalism. So hopefully he'll get there. But he's written this book called The Benedict Option, which is kind of a white hot thing in these conversations now. Now, can anyone guess why you'd call something the Benedict Option? What can you guess from the name? Well, so, but he became Orthodox, so he's essentially pardon? Yeah. And well, another way to work it out is why did Cardinal Ratzinger change his name to Pope Benedict? What was he signalling by that? Yeah, it's particularly, so Benedict, and one of the things, so Pope Benedict, one of the things he was signalling by choosing that as his name is he made a pivot toward Europe, whereas JP2 was much more oriented toward the majority world and obviously Poland, but also to Latin America and Africa and so on. Benedict, the German high-minded intellectual, pivoted toward Europe, and he called himself Benedict because the great quote of Benedict, of Saint Benedict, is pruned it grows. the kind of the motto or the axiom, because Benedict the Saint, as opposed to the Pope, did his work in the collapse of the Roman Empire. So Western civilization, the Roman Empire, the whole thing is collapsing all around you. What do you do in the face of the collapse of the civilization in which you were nurtured? And the Benedict option is to say, the way you describe it, say it's a strategic withdrawal. So what Benedict does is, well, what the kind of the myth of Benedict, at least, I'm not sure it, as a person to hang this idea on, is to say the society around me is collapsing. The language that I'm using is not making any sense to it, and we're just missing each other all over the place. And so Benedict goes away and builds Christian communities that within the Christian community, they're kind of more Christian than ever. Like, as in their prayer, you know, however many times a day, you know, this whole thing that's oriented around a rich, thick experience of Christian community and liturgy and blah, blah, blah. And it's a strategic withdrawal so that there's, and historically, so that it's the Benedictine monasteries that preserve the manuscripts of the New Testament and the ancient learning of Aristotle and all that sort of thing. And they become, the Benedictine monasteries become this kind of bridge across the Dark Ages. Every sentence I say now is controversial and contested and blah, blah, blah. But have a bridge across the Dark Ages so that when Western civilization sort of comes to its senses again, the Christian learning and Christian culture has been preserved. And so the Benedict option that Rogero talks about is to say that, and it's, you immediately pick in specifically in the American context, the loggerhead political battle of the 90s and 2000s, where we thought we could win back the culture, hasn't happened. So we need to build strong alternative Christian communities to weather the storm until the culture is ready to hear the gospel again. So that's the Benedict option, which is a huge area of discussion in these kinds of conversations. Now, I just want to pause there and get your gut reaction, whatever it is, to the Benedict option, so described.
Except for, I did a little bit of a reading on that, and one of the articles that I read, you mentioned, it's not a withdrawal in the sense of going into a ghetto and hiding.
Yes.
It is more of a, let's show them what they're missing.
Yes.
Let's be as Christian as we can.
Yep.
But not hide.
Yes. Yeah, that's right. So that's an important qualification on a fair reading of it, whether you think it's the worst thing in the world or the best thing in the world. A fair reading of it, exactly that he's not saying, let's withdraw Amish style, to place away from the world. He's saying, let's, have a strategic withdrawal. That's why that word's important. But continue to seek to bless the community from the vantage point of a thicker experience of Christian community. Yes, yeah.
Does that mean not engaging in the public sphere or still
engaging? Yes and no. So it means still engaging in the public square, both in the sense, say, you know, Orthodoxy kind of frames things a bit differently, which shapes some of this thinking, but that you continue to bear testimony to Christ and all that kind of thing. But you'd probably be less, I think partly he's saying in his American context, let's be a little less shrill and a little less expectant that eventually, if we say it enough times in persuasive enough language, they'll hear us. He's saying, actually, they're not hearing us, and every time we open our mouths, it gets worse. So he would say, instead of, maybe one way to put it, he's saying, at the moment we're blogging, let's go away and write books and do deeper, thicker work rather than shallow, argy-bargy work. Yeah. Yeah.
I can see value in that in my ministry. So yeah. Students, and one of the biggest and best things we do each year is a media conference.
Yes.
A retreat.
Yep.
For a whole week. And what we're doing is consolidating.
Mm-hmm.
We separate ourselves out and we thicken our Christian culture.
Yep.
And we get people out of the culture where they've got snippets of, you know, of conversations here and there about Christianity and momentary Bible studies that an hour doesn't seem to be enough to get deep enough. And we go away and have a longer conversation, we consolidate,
mm-hmm.
and we re-enter the world. So that doesn't fully capture what the question is, but I can see the attraction of going away and consolidating.
Yes, yep, that's right. And I think that... an author I'm about to talk about him now is Mark Sayers, who's a Melbourne pastor, written a book called The Disappearing Church, and a whole ton of other books. Very interesting, especially good at the intersection of culture and, he wrote his book before the Benedictine, and he talks about a dynamic of withdrawal and return that you have. And you have that motif in literature all the time of Hamlet, who goes away to England and then comes back to do his work, or same thing in The Lion King, because of course The Lion King is just Hamlet, when Simba goes away for a while and has fun with those other, what are they called? Yeah, those guys, yeah. Hakuna Matata. So there's this whole dynamic, withdrawal and return dynamic, and I think that's what happens. So in student work across Australia, again, one of the ways a sociologist might understand the modern atheist movement as a weirdly successful, not the right word, but a weirdly resilient part of the Christian scene, because it has, a sociologist I think would analyse that and say there's actually a very powerful community being established here, because of these huge time investments, where you're not saying to people, hey, come on this weekend, we're making it as easy as possible, we just have a Bible study in the morning, then we just play volleyball all afternoon. You actually, to almost comical degree, you say, this is going to happen from 8 o'clock in the morning till 9 o'clock at night, and then you sing to get ready for the next sermon, that's kind of this extended Q&A. And I think if you look at that as a believer, you look at all this content coming toward you and say, this is great that they're learning all this stuff. But if you look at it as a sociologist, there's other stuff going on there where the sheer act of that amount of time and energy, it's so counter. It's this alt universe of learning and seriousness and stuff. And often in the AFES movement, which I warmly support from the outside, I'm not an AFES worker, so I'm not trying to flatter myself in this, but often the NYC, they'll just hear more intelligent and better, communicated stuff than they will have heard all year at university. Like, it's just better read, smarter, better communicators that will be doing that. And so you have this powerful, experience, apart from the actual content that it was about the cross of the resurrection of the Holy Spirit, this powerful experience of, okay, there's the world, this kind of exclusive humanism, and this world out there that's kind of actually a bit thin and not that well communicated, and like don't really know that many people and stuff like that in my community. And there's this thick community of people that are deadly serious about this, and I have never thought as hard as I thought in a weekend when I was away in my holidays. It's a very powerful part of the sociology of atheists, I think. Yes?
I think it's also the relationship. I think relationships now are so much more scattered. Friends of a friend,
yeah.
But not actually spending time.
Yes.
We're getting less time for building relationships. So those kind of full on weekends.
Yeah.
People are coming home and knowing how to.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes. And it is a particular kind of relationship, because in a sense everything's a relationship, like every human being in Australia has a relationship with God of enmity and hostility. That's a relationship. I want them to be in a different relationship with God, because they're currently in a relationship with God that I don't think will go well for them. And similarly, I think that NYC experience is exchanging one set of thin, scrappy relationships for this quite thick, deep, rich experience, yeah. Yeah. Yes?
Is that what's behind where you mentioned before that you were always thinking that America are going with the Eastern Catechism and they're causing what people call the kids now?
Yeah, that's right. So I think that kind of, that whole kind of rebirth of, again, it's so weird, that rebirth of catechesis, even the use of the word catechesis, like in the 90s, just call it teaching. But you wear that kind of heavily now, and you notice that a lot of But, you know, like, you know, Mark Dever is a Baptist and Tim Keller is a Presbyterian, and people wear their kind of, those historic identities a lot more heavily, which is kind of so odd if you spent the 90s wanting to flatten stuff. But it is to do with that sense of, if this is going to stick, I've got to be part of something bigger. And it's got to be part of something that historically is older than last week, and that I use different language, and it's, and it's, there's a thing called catechesis, and it's never called that at my university, but it's called that in my church. And so Keller, who was one of the guys I was going to talk about, but fast running out of time, you know, a big part of the way he thinks and frames stuff is that, that ecclesiology of the city within the city and the city on a hill and all that kind of ecclesiological or kind of missiological positioning of the church. And the, his two most regular, examples are the Jewish community and the LGBT community, which are both minority groups with incredibly thick community. And so, you know, if you're, grew up in a Jewish family in New York, Jews are a significant part of New York, but numerically very much a minority, but well and truly, punch above their weight in their cultural influence, because the Jewish system of Sabbath and synagogue and the food laws and stuff like that, which are kind of part of what they function as, is to just remind you that you belong to something bigger and older and deeper and richer than the thing you face during the day. Or another, I think another good example is, you know, in the great Irish migrations, more Protestant Irish moved to the, to America than Catholic Irish. But if you go to, Boston or to Chicago, you'll see a St. Patrick's Day march. You'll never see an Ulster, or you'll never see an Orangeman's march. Because as you go to, from the Protestant North and some of the Protestant South, as you migrated to America, you got there and thought, same, same. No need to defend my identity. This feels about right. They're Protestant, we're Protestant, I'm Protestant. Whereas if you were from the Catholic, South of Ireland, the Catholic Republic, and you went there, you fiercely maintained your identity, and had, and so to this day, there's such a thing as Catholic, and the others have just kind of disappeared. And so I think that's a big part of the way Keller's trying to think, is to say, we can become that creative kind of minority, that, that forms people. And like you say, well, like I say, like I just said, not all migration is created equal. Like, the extent to which you make peace with your culture is the extent to which you disappear. And the extent to which you maintain a distinctive alternative view of what it is to be human and community and blah, 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 is, it seems to be the extent to which you kind of survive and can thrive. Yes. So, I don't want to say that the seeker stuff was, it would have been ridiculous and unconscionable, I think, to continue to make church as hard as we made it for people to understand. But I think it would be to our death to sell out our Christian distinctives. And I think the more, especially with that, that bit of data about the power of families, I don't think the solution to that is to become this kind of crazy pro-family, situation. I think the insight is to say that, of course we need to be pro-family as opposed to anti-family, but we need to create Christian communities that have that family-like ability to form people, including people, who are without families or between families or from broken families. I'll give you this thing from, Mark Sayer. So Mark puts it like this. He says that, I think I can get it right. This is Mark on missiology. You had, he talks about, so you think about two types of cultures. So you have culture type one, which is, historically most humans for most time, is a culture of, animism, of religion, localized religion, fear, you know, just kind of like what most humans were in most situations. And if you think of culture two as Western Christian culture, and so, Western Christian culture has got a message, well, we have got a message that we want to come across to here and to be part of this culture. So, bad missiology just transplants that onto that and just says, you become this or you come here. Good missiology, goes from you know, Judeo-Christian, Western, monotheistic, Christianized stuff to hear, and is very sensitive to think about the thought forms and patterns of how to get that across and to not screw it up with some cultural impositions or inappropriate cultural impositions, in the one side. But then, this is Marx's analysis, he says that you have he would describe the modern West, especially since the 1960s, but with roots from Descartes onwards, as not a first culture, but a third culture. So he says that the modern West, the place where you and I live and move and do our witness and ministry, is to take our message and to ask the exact same questions, what are the thought forms and how do I make this make sense to them, is not symmetrical, because this culture is not pre-Christian, it's post-Christian. I'm a little bit careful about that term, but it's shaped by not that. So contemporary sexual morality is not just something that you have to think, how do I explain this best? You've got to understand that it is being explained, you're explaining it to a movement that on purpose rejected exactly that, and that's why he says that if you do this, you very rarely, all sorts of mistakes have been made in the history of mission, but it's rarely that swallows that. So the strength of monotheistic thought and the great Christian tradition and so on means that if that's either accepted or rejected, and the question of relevance really matters. But if you think of this problem as primarily one of relevance, then what happens is that you get evangelized back and they win. So that the third culture, the way Tim Keller puts it, which is an analogous point, not exactly the same, is that he said evangelizing in the West, it's like trying to give the gospel to people who have been immunized against the gospel. So, you know, immunization, you get a little bit of the sickness, and that protects you from the real thing. And Mark Sayers would say that you actually, it's a little bit more hostile than that, that this, it's got to be understood as exactly not that. The way Charles Taylor understands this is that he has his whole history of Western culture where he says that in the medieval and Reformation, up to the Reformation period, you had this ordered consensus about God and society and order, and everyone then was as enthusiastic about sleeping with people they weren't married to as we all are, but the whole culture worked to undermine those kind of instincts, to say, hey, don't do that. I know you want to, but don't, because we've got bigger fish to fry here. We're trying to build a culture and we're trying to do society. And it was communal, so that's why, you know, we look back on people getting burnt for heresy and we're like, that's your private opinion. How could you possibly get in trouble for heresy? But if your religion was the way you did community, that was your shared language, then it's a threat to the whole community if one of you has become a heretic. And not justifying that, but that's how it works. And within that culture, you had carnival or Mardi Gras, where because it was so demanding to live under that kind of code and rule, these emergent forms of carnival and Mardi Gras emerged, where for a night or a week or for just before Lent, in the village, the littlest kid wore the mitre of the bishop, and people dressed and you know, like on All Hallows Eve, you'd kind of dress like the demons because you were kind of teasing the demons, and you'd have these periodic things where the opposite of your culture happened for a night to give you the release valve to come back to the demands of the of regular life. Now, again, not saying we should, just saying descriptively a case of what happened. And Taylor says that the kind of carnival or Mardi Gras has taken over. So this culture is, it's permanently the opposite of that. And so you're not going into that and saying, hey, what about one guy? You're like, I hadn't thought about that before because I used to worship my ancestors. They're like, you're like, hey, what about, being, faithful to people, you know, faithful in singleness and marriage, and how about doing this, that, and the other? And they're not like, I hadn't thought about that before. They're like, we are entirely shaped by the carnival objection to that main thing. So, I'll give you the third. work out how to frame this first. So anyway, what you because of that thing, what you want is Mark calls this gospel relevance. Which works here, but doesn't work here. Because that polarizes that. And so he says that what we're after, which I really like this phrase, is gospel, how to spell it? Gospel resilience. So what we should be doing, the problem of our time, which was important work in the, before us, but the problem at our moment is not that we're not relevant, that the message would be received if we only worked out the right words. It is being kind of actively rejected, not by any given individual, like it's not like a person, everyone wakes up and thinks, how can I be not Christian today? But the shape of the culture. And so, I think we need to work out being gospel resilient and building ministries that help people to be resilient, because that's our challenge. So I'm going to finish with these. Here are my kind of five things. Catechesis, I've even used that word. I think the challenge for us to create those well-taught, thick and deep communities means that our teaching needs to be deep and profound. I think we can afford to be less shy about historical theology. I think we can afford to let people know that they're in the sweep of something that's bigger than them, bigger than last week, that there's such a thing as Christians who have thought about this stuff already, and that we need to build for the long term resilient people rather than relevant people. So deep catechesis, thick community, so you know that language of thick and thin, not meant in terms of people's mental capacities, but in the gravitational pull of a community. So here's here's an Aussie kid and two generations in New York and you've got no idea. It's just like some historic thing that maybe they were Aussie once because I don't know why. But you know what I mean? If you were, your grandchildren, if you brought them up in New York, would just like, whatever. Whereas Jewish people, generation after generation, they're still Jewish, because there are these disciplines and practices of, being together in community and, as Leslie Newbegin says, the church is the hermeneutic of the gospel, that the thing both experientially and I think theologically that aids and abets the reception of the gospel is that being lived out in the life of a Christian community. So I know there's a kind of tension around the idea of belonging before you believe, and I don't agree with that in the Roman Catholic sense, that if you hang around a church close enough you accidentally become a Christian. But I do think we have to do our evangelism aware that people will probably need to belong for a long time before they believe. That people getting involved in your church, in your Christian community, coming up and rubbing up against Christian lives lived is a really important part of people becoming Christian. So thick communities, formative liturgies, this comes from James K.A. Smith, who's always on about liturgy. And again, people get nervous and they go, oh, he means things he doesn't mean. What he wants to say is that he wants to think about the world in liturgical terms. So he says that when you go to the supermarket, when you watch Rage, when you flick through Facebook and so on, he says that is not secular, it's liturgical. It's a formative process that's trying to shape the way you think and move and the things that you... And liturgy, he says, addresses not just what you think, but also what you love, and that people are shaped more fundamentally by their loves than by their thoughts. And so he says that if all week you're in the secular liturgy of... Because, you know, supermarkets and your shopping centres, they're kind of almost cathedral-like, and they're... like liturgy, they're timeless. That you go into a supermarket and it's like a kind of casino or a cathedral. You don't know what time it is because it's just always light in there and it runs on its own kind of time. And he says that's a shaping thing. And so the practices that we adopt in our churches and our communities, I think we need to be self-conscious that they're not just places to impart information, but places that form our lives and who we are. Worldview preaching, I think that the way I describe this is that the message, I think, in the 1950s and early 1960s, if you listen to Billy Graham, his essential message is, this is not fair to the way he said it, he says, it's kind of like, you're not Christian enough. Because that you speak to a culture that's ostensibly Christian and has high church attendance, and you say, you must be born again. Which is the exact message you give to a group of people who think, oh, I was baptized, I was like, you know, of course I'm Christian, because I'm a Christian country, all these things. And you have to say to that culture, you must be born again. But that is different. That's exactly what you should say. But we're in a situation where people, so I draw two icebergs, and most of the stuff that happens is beneath the iceberg. So I think as preachers, I think the way we need to think about our teaching is to not go from a shallow understanding, well, this is always true, but you shouldn't go from a shallow understanding of the text to a shallow understanding of the person and say, this text says don't murder, and so you should murder, and please don't, and see you next week. And I think this is where I do find Tim Keller's preaching a really helpful model, and I think Philip Jensen was like this as well, for an Australian example, to think, what is driving this text? Like, what is driving the do not murder command? What is the theology, the worldview of a view of the world where humans are made in the image of God, and that to murder another human being is to deface and blaspheme. It's a religious problem if you murder people because you're committing a blasphemy, and to think deeply as you can about that, and then to think as deeply as you can about the other person and what's in their head, so that you're heard, to eventually, hopefully the result is the same, that people don't murder at the end of it. But we need to think deeply about those things. Then, finally, the apologetic pivot. I think the apologetic pivot, or the way to think about the big thing to call the world on, I think, is the ludicrous but almost universally believed idea that secularism is a neutral, obvious, self-evidential way to be in the world. And that's where Charles Taylor's book is so helpful. He just demonstrates time and time again that it's a completely contingent, somewhat irrational way that we are, that at all sorts of points in history might have been different, but for technological reasons and intellectual reasons and so on. I'm going to end with this PowerPoint. There's a billboard. I think this really captures it. This was for the 2016 census. Not religious anymore. And then it says, encouraging you to tick the no religion box. Now, if you look at that sign, if it said not religious, mark no in the census, I reckon that would just be a public service announcement. Hey guys, not religious? Like this. But not religious anymore is not a service announcement, it's a story. Because that's telling you a story about the world you live in and say, hey, it's like when you're selling, you know, the person that says to you, do you want this, as you walk past them in the street, versus the person that said, hey, did you miss out on one of these? It's always a different dynamic. It's like, oh, and you think, not religious anymore. Oh, why am I? Is everyone else not religious? I shouldn't be there. And that one sentence is a bit like Trump. You know, if in Trump's campaign where it says, make America great, that would be a lame thing. Make America great again is a story. It's a mythological story about what once was and what will be. Just like that is a mythological story about our culture. That we had this encumbering thing called Christianity, and most of the smart guys have got rid of it, and it's getting vacuumed up, and things will be better, and hopefully we're not all religious anymore. And I think one of the ways we as preachers and teachers and commenders of the gospel is to, at least for your own personal edification, realise that that's a made-up scenario. All right, I'm going to pray, and then we're done. Father God, we thank you for the chance to commend the gospel to this generation, to call people to repentance and faith in light of your coming judgment and in light of the sacrifice of Jesus. And we pray, Lord, that we would be as relevant as we need to be so that the truth of the gospel is actually understood, but to build gospel resilience in ourselves and in the people that we serve so that they would be cheerfully resilient and confident and joyful in the truth that you've given us, in the communities that you are forming us in the power of your word to be the seed of the gospel that brings new life. And so, Father, help us to be faithful in our age, to not be intimidated, to not give way to fear, but to confidently hold out the word of life. In Jesus' name, amen.